Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today, coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus here in AM 580 WILL. Our guest today, Danny Schechter, is a television producer and independent filmmaker who also writes and speaks about media issues. He's the author of several books, including Falun Gong's Challenge to China, The More You Watch, The Less You Know, and News Dissector, Passions, Pieces, and Polemics. He's the author of a brand new book that's just come out called Embedded, Weapons of Mass Deception, about the press coverage, obviously, of the war in Iraq. Danny Schechter is also the executive director of MediaChannel.org, the world's largest online media issues network, and he's the co-founder and executive director of Global Vision, a New York-based television and film production company. Danny Schechter has a long and storied career as a journalist working for ABC, for CNN, having programming on PBS. He's a civil rights activist, and he's an author and a writer whose work has appeared in venues ranging from The Nation to Newsday, Columbia Journalism Review, and Village Voice. It is my great pleasure to welcome to Media Matters Danny Schechter.
Thank you, Bob, and I'm you know, it's great to be back on with you. As this issue that we've both been so concerned about has gone from being a complaint for so many people to a serious political issue and moral concern that's galvanized millions of people, and I think that your work and the work of John Nichols and MediaReform.net and all of your colleagues have played a fantastic job in putting this FCC issue on the agenda and really touching into a deep nerve in the American people about media and how central it is to our lives and to our, you know, alarm, if you will.
You know, Danny, I think one of the areas that your concerns about media are greatest is when coverage of the most important issues in people's lives. And I think clearly one of the most important issues any government can undertake, if not the most important, is the decision to go to war, to have a war. And your new book deals directly with that. Tell us a little bit about your book. What is it about?
Well,
and where, you know, what's your argument?
During the Iraq War, I was sort of self-embedded at my computer, writing, you know, almost 3,000 words a day from many different sources about what was actually happening in the media coverage of the war, trying to figure out, A, are we being well-informed? What is it that people in other parts of the world are seeing and hearing that Americans are not? And, you know, and how the media system has actually become part of the war system. In the old days, media saw itself as the fourth estate, somehow separate and apart from government. In this war, Commander Tommy Franks spoke of the media as the fourth front of the war in terms of his war planning. So the media's integration, if you will, and encapsulation into the whole war strategy as cheerleader and promoter was a crucial part of American propaganda strategy and war strategy. And most Americans don't know that because there was nobody embedded in the propaganda apparatus of the U.S. government seeing how media coverage was in part orchestrated or at least influenced by the Pentagon. So what I tried to do is read widely from as many sources as I could in this country and overseas and try to write daily about actually what happened and add perspective to it. So, you know, here's what Fox is saying, here's what CNN is reporting, here's MSNBC, here's ABC, NBC, and here's what is also being covered by the BBC and Al Jazeera and other sources. And so I found out, you know, really that there were three wars going on at the same time. You know, one of them was the war we saw, and the war sort of aimed at us, the media war aimed at us. The other was the war that Europeans saw, and the third was the war that the Arab world saw. And they were very different in their emphasis, in their structure of presentation, in their political outlook. And just goes to show you, you know, that reality doesn't only have one explanation or one way of, you know, viewing it. There are many different ways of looking at the world. And here was an instance where facts themselves were disputed and their meaning and interpretation was disputed by different news outlets.
Well, I think in one sense, there can be reasonable disagreements and varied perspectives, but is your argument simply that these are three different interpretations, all of equal value?
No. I think clearly the pre-war period, the build-up to war, the orchestration of a sense of alarm, a sense of threat and danger from weapons of mass destruction from the Iraqis that, you know, could reach London in 45 minutes, that could, you know, somehow threaten America in a serious way, the Al-Qaeda-Iraq connection, which seemed to have been concocted and invented, constructed, if you will, you know. All of these things help create the climate for war, and the lack of critical coverage by most media outlets, not all, but most, essentially conveyed to the American people a sense that this validated what the government was saying rather than, you know, raise questions about it. Now, after the war, we're finding out, A, there are no weapons of mass destruction anybody has found. B, there are more terrorists in Iraq now than there was before the war, that the war may have been a magnet for terrorists to come to Iraq. You know, that in a sense, almost everything we thought was true wasn't, or was only a partial part of the story. We can see that now, maybe with a little bit of hindsight, but at the time, there was a drumbeat of sort of proper news, PROPA, you know, propaganda news, coming our way. And because media companies, in a sense, did not critique what was going on, did not offer other perspectives and anti-war perspectives, critical perspectives, in the same way that they did pro-government perspectives, the imbalance was dramatic of the political views of the various experts and pundits and generals and others that they had on the air. It's not surprising that the American public actually got an impression of what was going on that went beyond what the news was even saying by inference. And this was the notion that somehow there were Iraqis on the planes that crashed into the World Trade Center, that there was a very firm link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. All of those points, you know, there was a recent poll that shows that more Americans believe that now than believed it before. So we have a sort of runaway public opinion that's not tied to any real evidence, because evidence is not what the news organizations were projecting. What they were projecting is with images, impressions, and a kind of structured, entertainment-oriented style of presentation. Time magazine called it Millietainment.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Danny Schechter is the executive director and executive editor, of MediaChannel.org, author of the new book, Embedded, Weapons of Mass Deception. Danny's been a guest on our show before. It's always a pleasure to have him here. If you'd like to call in and ask Danny Schechter a question, the number at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Danny, you mentioned that two of them.
I just want to add one point. I mean,
sure thing.
The book is basically, we published the book, Media Channel published the book with one of our affiliates in Canada, GoldType.net, as an ebook.
Oh, it's an
so
ebook.
It's available on the internet. At the end of this month, it's going to come out from Prometheus Books as a book. But in order to get this out quickly, and you know, it includes coverage of the conflict through August, so it's pretty timely and up to date.
And where should people go then if they want to track it down?
If you come to MediaChannel.org and you come to my weblog, you'll see that there's an ad for the book, and you can buy it online. You can download it, and it will be out in the stores hopefully by the beginning of next month or the end of this month. So
yeah,
we're trying to move as quick as possible.
And even if someone doesn't necessarily want that book, I would urge you to go to MediaChannel.org. If you're interested in the issues we talk about on Media Matters, those are the sort of issues that are taken up at MediaChannel.org on a daily basis. Danny, now a couple, you talked already about two of the main reasons given for the U.S. Invasion of Iraq were the connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, the terrorism, the alleged connection, and likewise the alleged ability of Iraq and Saddam Hussein to use weapons of mass destruction, the threat they pose to the rest of the world, including especially the United States, the justification for a preemptive strike. Now, both of those, as you've pointed out, have pretty much collapsed at this point and don't hold up to much analysis. There's little evidence. In fact, the evidence tends to move in the other direction. There's a third argument, though, now that is given by defenders of the war that was given somewhat before the war, but now has become the major plank, which is the argument, well, this is always a fight about democracy. about ridding the Middle East of a regime everyone agreed pretty much was a thug regime, an awful place to live with no respect for human rights and civil liberties, and replacing it with a liberal democratic regime that would respect majority rule and the rule of law and all the values that Americans are supposed to uphold. Is the press covered this issue well? I mean, how legitimate is this? So what does this have to do with what's actually taking place in Iraq?
Well, you know, first of all, we've had a sort of bizarre co-optation from a kind of far-right wing evangelical president has sort of expropriated the rhetoric of the left, words like liberation. So he's had a kind of right-wing liberation theology. Words like human rights have been selectively applied to Saddam Hussein without any background, you know, pointing out that it was a Republican administration that had armed Saddam Hussein with the actual nerve gas that was used against the Kurds, that the U.S. government did not respond for nearly 6 months after it was confirmed that gas had been used against Kurdish people by the Iraqis. And even there's some questions about whether or not it might have been the Iranians, because they were also targeted. You know, both sides were using gas apparently in that conflict. So there's a lot to that we still don't know. We do know that the response to it was hardly, you know, self-righteous. And subsequent to that incident, Donald Rumsfeld himself and other U.S. senators went and met with Saddam Hussein. We're doing business with him right up until the eve of the Gulf War. So, you know, the problem with the coverage is, yes, some facts are reported, but it's selective. And what's left out, the omissions, are really often the most defining of what's actually going on. So the coverage was, you know, superficial, tended to accept the government definition, the way the government framed the problem, as being valid without very much concern. I mean, even today in Iraq, all these people you read every day, that we've arrested, we've gone into people's homes, we've arrested. How are these people being held? There's no judicial system. There were no prisons even set up. There's no courts to try them. What kind of human rights is that? But that's never pointed out as a human rights problem. It's pointed out as a chaos of war problem. So, you know, again, the lack of scrutiny, the lack of real in-depth concern about this is very troubling. For me, it's ironic because our company did a series called Rights and Wrongs, Human Rights Television, for 4 years. And we first started our program, our first kind of special was about Saddam Hussein's human rights abuses. And a PBS executive, a public television executive here in New York, refused to air the show on the grounds that we didn't have a comment from Saddam Hussein, you know, to balance the story, right? Mm-hmm. We were relying on human rights and the Kurdish sources for the story. And, you know, on one level they were right. On the other level, of course, you couldn't get a comment from Saddam Hussein on all this. We did find some dismissal by an Iraqi official, which we did integrate into the piece in a kind of pro forma way. But, you know, later public television said that human rights itself is an insufficient organizing principle for a TV series and wouldn't support our show. We had to go station by station. The point is that the discovery of all of this, you know, now is very selective and extremely political. And in fact, what we have later learned, which is very interesting, I don't even know if you know this, that while public television was rejecting our series on human rights, they gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to a guy named David Horowitz and his partner named Lionel Chetwynd, right-wing producers from and propaganda operation from California, to develop public television programs that would give a challenge to programs like Frontline, you know, from a right-wing point of view. Most recently, Chetwynd is the producer of a docudrama that's been running on Showtime called DC 9/11, which is a drama purporting to show how the Bush administration responded to 9/11, casting the president, you know, in a heroic, iconic fashion, you know, totally one-sided, completely dismissive of a lot of the critical information that we now know about what actually happened. And so this is the guy that was getting funding at a time when human rights was not being funded, when it was still possible to try to do something about Iraq in a different way. So all, you know, these this background, this context, tends to get is missing in most of the news accounts.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We do have phone lines open. The number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We do have a caller. Champagne, you're on the air with Danny Schechter.
Hi. I'd like to switch the focus a little bit. They announced that you had written a book on Falun Gong, and I was just wondering about you know, human rights abuses in China in regard to them, and why they're seen as a threat to the Chinese government. Are they political, or is it simply that they are a separate organization that organizes outside of dominant ideology?
Yeah, actually, they're not an organization. They're sort of spiritual practice that was perceived as threatening by the Chinese government, in part because Chinese government estimates suggested there were as many as 100 million Chinese who were practicing Falun Gong, which is a sort of spiritual practice that combines physical exercises with meditation and with a sort of belief in self-improvement and you know, mind-body relationship sort of thing. Some of it's mystical, some of it's very pragmatic. At any rate, the Chinese government outlawed Falun Gong and has, for several years now, has been putting its practitioners in prison, killing many of them, without much of an outcry from the U.S. government, certainly in part because China is our number one trading partner now, and many American businesses are doing business in China and cooperating with the Chinese laws that discriminate against Falun Gong practitioners. And I got involved in this as a human rights journalist, concerned about a story that I felt was being underreported, and I wrote a book and I did a film about it.
Right, so they just keep in touch by the Internet, and that somehow was a threat.
Well, the Internet is one tool that they have used. You know, since China outlawed Falun Gong has now spread globally. It's like hitting the tip of a toothpaste tube. They're now, you know, in over 40 countries around the world. There are practitioners in 104 cities and towns in America. So it's been a very, you know, fast-spreading practice. Many people are attracted to it. I'm not a Falun Gong practitioner myself, but and my book, Falun Gong's Challenge to China, offers, you know, kind of an analysis of how Falun Gong started, how it spread, what it thinks, what the China, and it offers perspectives from the Chinese government and independent observers and human rights groups. I did the last interview with the founder of Falun Gong, so I was able to, you know, ask him questions that nobody's been able to ask him since.
Did he die in prison or something?
No, he's still alive, living in, we're told, somewhere in the New York area.
And going back to human rights in Iraq, I'm just wondering if the fact that we really don't seem to have done a very thorough investigation of what has been found there in terms of graves, do you think that's because we don't really want to be associated with that?
Well, you know, first of all, in 1991, many Iraqis, particularly in the South, rose up in response to a, you know, suggestion by George Bush, our, you know, senior as opposed to lesser, you know, calling on them to rise up, and Saddam Hussein then slaughtered many people with the U.S. standing by and doing nothing, and both in the North and in the South. So many of the people killed, there was a sort of, they feel, American complicity in those deaths. So that's one factor. There has been quite a bit of focus on human rights, which is good, but again, extremely selective. What I think we need to try to look into is how Saddam Hussein got into power in the first place, okay, which was apparently with CIA support. You know, the U.S., and also because he was killing communists in Iraq, you may not know that. So the whole idea was to try to, by the U.S. covertly, was to support religious fundamentalists and extreme anti-communist people like the Shah in Iran or Saddam in Iraq to try to contain what the U.S. then perceived as the central threat, which was nationalism and communism, particularly in Iran, where you had a nationalist government elected that was nationalizing the oil. So a lot of this had to do with economic interests and political ideology as part of the Cold War.
And weren't the Ba'athists also socialists and highly nationalist, and perhaps Saddam Hussein just kind of went on the nationalist emphasis?
Well, they were socialists, but they were kind of national socialists, you know, in the kind of way that the Germans were. You know what I mean? They had a very authoritarian model. They were very brutal in the way they organized things. There was no dissent. It was organized around the supreme leader. You know, there was government, you know, involvement in the economy. And, you know, like Mussolini, the trains ran on time. There were great schools and the, you know, middle class developed in Iraq that's very sophisticated. You know, this is not a peasant society. This was a very developed society. But the war actually, you know, has been going on for 12 years. And the society, because of sanctions and because of other abuses aided and abetted by the U.S. and the West, debilitated, you know, Iraq, destroyed a lot of its economy, and, you know, in the guise of punishing one person, punished an entire nation.
All right, well, thank you very much, caller, for calling. I want to move on, if that's all right. Danny, let me say to the callers again, if you'd like to call in, the number here, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. In the next 3 weeks on Media Matters, our guests will include next week, a week from today, Jim Boughton, the baseball pitcher. You know Jim Boughton, don't you, Danny?
Sure.
Yeah, he has a new book out called Foul Ball, which deals with his effort to save a ballpark in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and how he went up against the Singleton newspaper chain, which owned the monopoly mm-hmm. paper in that town, which had a real estate deal it wanted instead, and how he fought them. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks from today, we have John Wilson from nearby Bloomington Normal, who's going to come in to talk about some of his work. And 3 weeks from today, an old friend of Danny Schechter's, Noam Chomsky, will be our guest here on Media Matters. Danny, let's go back to Iraq today. You follow it closely. You follow the press coverage. You know, what was the – I mean, we had this heroic victory in the military battle that took place a few months ago now. And since then, it seems like it has not been that heroic of a victory for the United States. And, you know, what is – what's – I mean, we're getting a much more negative view in the news media about it. But, I mean, is it an accurate view? What is the press coverage today telling us, and what are we missing about what's taking place in Iraq today?
You know, I mean, first of all, I think the administration had convinced itself, okay, and had been convinced by people like Chalabi of the Iraq National Congress, you know, that the Iraqi people, so tired of Saddam, so we welcome them with open arms, throw, you know, kind of rose petals to them, and that, oh, everybody would live happily ever after. And so it's clear that the U.S. had a kind of military plan, even though you know, that was successful, even though, of course, it was a complete, you know, disproportionate fight. I mean, we had all the technology and all the weaponry and et cetera and so forth. The Iraqi army, you know, it was a joke. Most of the Iraqi military people left. But then, as we saw, there was no plan what to do next. And as a consequence, there was total chaos. Some say the U.S. government helped orchestrate it to try to underscore the need for their continuing involvement. Some say it was just chaos, and by not dealing with the structures of the old Iraqi government, they created a vacuum which led to this kind of situation. You know, whenever you have occupation, military occupation, you're going to have resistance to it, because occupiers, particularly 20-year-old kids who have no idea of Iraqi culture, no idea of Iraqi society, don't speak the language, et cetera, are going to be, you know, rather, you know, overbearing, you know, if not brutal, with the people who they are, you know, feel it might be a threat to them. And we've had incidents like the other day where, you know, a number of Iraqi policemen who were trained by the U.S. and supported by the U.S. were then killed by the U.S. in an incident where the United States sort of apologized. But I didn't read anything in the New York Times today about compensation, any attempt at reconciliation, any attempt at, you know, attempting to pacify the situation. I don't think that's even on the card. So you're going to have more of these incidents. And I think what started as an effort, supposedly, you know, motivated because there were terrorists in Iraq, have actually produced terrorists, and there's now a guerrilla war underway. It's interesting the other day that the Pentagon had a screening of the movie Battle of Algiers, and if your viewers haven't, or listeners haven't seen it, they should try. It's a movie about the Algerian War and about the resistance.
This is in the late 1950s.
To the French. It's a very dramatic film, and Now the Pentagon, you know, we my generation looked at this in the 60s as a kind of model of heroic resistance. Now the Pentagon is looking at it, trying to figure out ways to mount counterinsurgency operations. But clearly, you know, this, you know, the post-war war may be more brutal than the first war, and more people have died in many instances.
How is the European media, or how are the Arabic language media reporting the current situation in Iraq differently from the mainstream U.S.
media?
Well,
I think, you know, the consensus seems to be U.S. blew it, you know, U.S. mistakes, U.S. should get out, and that they should try to transfer responsibility to the U.N. This is a French position, which is sort of, you know, French have gone out front with it because they can stand up to the United States. Others, you know, haven't but seem to endorse that view. The U.S. tried to cut the U.N. out totally. Now they're kind of clawing back to the U.N., trying to get the U.N. to play a role. Because when you have the U.N. there, then there's plausible deniability. So that's the U.N.'s fault, not ours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have that kind of fall guy in place right now. And because of pride and what we in New York would call chutzpah, you know, they believe that they, because we, you know, we want it's ours, you know, and we're not going to give authority to anybody else.
Yeah, and that seems to be sort of a problem in the Iraq situation today because, I mean, if the United States is there to create a democracy, is there any sense in your mind that if there was an election held today that the people the U.S. want to win would win the election?
I don't think so. I mean, first of all, there's no tradition of democratic elections in Iraq. There's no constitution. There's no court system. I mean, apparently, the most telling thing was that before the war, apparently there was a major Iraqi general who was dealing with the CIA, and the CIA essentially was recommending that we make a deal with this guy, and that then use the structure of his troops and to run Iraq afterwards. The neocons, the people in Washington who are driving the policy for Bush, basically said, no, we have to destroy the structure of Saddam, et cetera, and so forth. And, you know, essentially overruled that. So they went ahead with the sort of unilateral preemptive war strategy. They didn't build allies. And they created a vacuum. And that's what we're seeing, you know, work out here every day. More Americans getting killed, and a demand now by the Bush administration for $87 billion for Iraq. And there was just a poll reported this morning that showed that 52% of the American people are against it, which suggests that the president's, you know, rhetoric isn't working anymore. You know, you see him speaking, he goes to speak at military bases with soldiers who work for him, you know, cheering behind him. It looks like something out of Brezhnev's Russia.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in and speak with us, have a question or comment, the number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. We have a weekly email that we send out to listeners who would like it, a Media Matters update, which tells about upcoming guests, previous guests, and gives links to their articles, their books, information you'd like about them. If you'd like to get on this email list that we send out, and we don't use it for commercial purposes or hand it out to other people, all you need to do is email our producer, Victor Picard, and Victor's email address is vpicard, V-P-I-C-K-A-R-D, at uiuc.edu. Okay, well, let's go back to the phone lines now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Danny Schechter.
Hello. I was talking to a friend on the telephone the other day, and he referred to the current president as the modern-day Jimmy Carter. And while that's kind of an insult to Jimmy Carter, I think what he meant was that the situation in Iraq will not be resolved. There will not be help from Europe at all until this president is gone. And I wonder if you see that to be true. Is there any evidence that that's the case? That's all.
Well, you know, it certainly has been true in the past that it's taken new administrations to implement new policies. I mean, there are people saying, for example, that one of the reasons that the Bush administration ignored al-Qaeda or what's supposed to be al-Qaeda, the threat of terrorism, was because the former administration was saying this is an important issue because they said it. They wanted to do their own thing and just didn't deal with it. So I think it makes sense historically to say, you know, an administration comes in, has new policies. This one doesn't seem to be very willing to change its policy, although it has made some noises to that effect, going back to the UN, mildly chastising Israel in terms of its threats to Yasser Arafat that are current, being willing to recognize that certain things aren't working. But basically their strategy has been to try to change the subject. And that is where the media comes in, by allowing the administration to define a frame what the news is, and then just react to it in terms of how it's defined. It provides sort of one narrative, one way of looking at the world. And the counter narrative, the more critical narrative, is the one that's missing often in our media. Although even media outlets that have been very bullish about Bush are at least now acknowledging that there is a controversy and are covering it to some degree.
Yeah, Danny, along these lines, I mean, you look at the, as we talked about really casually at the beginning of the show, and we've mentioned it casually, now sort of this ho-hum. But, you know, we have gone to this enormous war that's now going to cost into the hundreds of billions of dollars and is leading to serious problems for, you know, world peace and terrorism and all sorts of issues. And it was led, we went into this war basically on the grounds there being weapons of mass destruction that were a distinct threat to us, first and foremost, and secondly, that there was some strong link to terrorism, to the Iraq regime. Both of these have now been shown to be basically bogus, or if they are criteria, they were criteria that would apply to maybe two dozen other nations before you would get to Iraq on the list. And in that case, I mean, it seems, isn't it bizarre we're being so casual about this? Someone taking us into war, getting lots of people killed, costing hundreds of billion dollars on lies? I mean, where's William Bennett's outrage?
You have two problems here. First, many members of Congress, including some of the Democratic presidential candidates, were complicit in all this and that they supported the president and were afraid to criticize him and didn't speak up. Certainly the media has taken as one of its sort of storylines this whole thing of the terror threat and you know, what they now call, I don't know, have you heard this phrase, Bob, GWAT, Global War on Terror. It's the new acronym, GWAT. You know, they've made this as the central issue. It's very hard now to look back and say, well, maybe we were wrong about this. I mean, I've just interviewed a guy here, Robert Pelton, who was out in Afghanistan. He's the guy that covered, I'm trying to make a film about the issues raised in my book called WMD. And so I've been doing some interviews with journalists. And this guy's the guy that interviewed John Walker Lind, the CNN. He had the big scoop with the American Taliban. Anyway, you know, he's here basically telling me Al-Qaeda is a myth. It doesn't exist. None of the jihadis, as he calls them, who he met, even know, referred to Al-Qaeda, even knew what it was. Neither did John Walker Lind. That it was actually the name of a guest house that Osama bin Laden ran. It's now been elevated into a, you know, kind of conspiracy of tremendous power and scope that justifies all these expenses. And basically, he was extremely skeptical. He even thinks that there was no real war in Iraq because most of the Iraqis went home and didn't fight it. So a lot of our perceptions of things and the reality that they're based on can be very far apart. And this is the problem. How do you get the media now to say, God, we were wrong. I'm sorry. You know, maybe we didn't do this properly. He told me another story, which will be hopefully in this film if it ever gets made and funded, about he was hired by 60 Minutes to go find he had a tip about the existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, a hard evidence or a hard tip. And he actually went out to find them. And when he got to the place, found that they had been looted, the weapons that he was told were looted. And were reported back and told what happened. They said, well, you didn't find them. There's no story here. But actually, the story was that they had been looted, you know. The story was that they weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And that story was not the story they set out to find, so they decided not to run that story. And there's a lot of things like that where, you know, when reality proves to be different than what you think it is, you just don't cover it.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 if you have any questions. Danny, I mean, you've been following media coverage for a long time, writing about it, studying it. You are a prominent print and broadcast journalist. as you look at the coverage of President Bush, do you think it follows pretty much the same manner the press covered President Clinton, or are there differences you notice in the way these two presidents are handled?
And we saw, you know, the press during the Clinton administration became an attack dog, okay? You know, the assumption was the man, you know, when is he lying? When he opens his mouth, you know? The president was treated in a way that just, you know, kind of dismissed, denigrated him. He was the subject of jokes, and the criticism was extremely, you know, horrendous. So it was attack dog coverage. Bush administration, lapdog coverage, you know. He's a statesman. He's a man being tested by, the data changed everything, 9/11, et cetera, and so forth. And I think the Bush administration has been very skillful at using public relations and using various media techniques. You know, he has a whole unit, for example, that just lights him. You know, whenever he speaks anywhere, it's sort of Hollywood-style lighting behind him. The photo op on the aircraft carrier being another instance. But he, you know, he's been very well managed and promoted, whereas the Democrat, you know, I just saw Howard Dean on C-SPAN in New York. His eyes were black. You couldn't even see him. There was no lighting at this particular rally. I mean, these guys are just, you know, outclass the Democrats in terms of their presentation. And he's been able to, you know, even his deficits, this is what's interesting, you know, even his deficits, people like, you know, people on the left laugh at him, the global village idiot, he can't get a sentence out straight, blah, 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 just put the guy down, he's a jerk, blah, blah, blah. You know, and so when people say that, what did the Republicans say? Came back and said, like back in Florida, you know, who would you rather have a beer with? George Bush, Mr. Nice Guy, or, you know, Al Gore, Mr. Smarty Pants, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so they played to a populist sentiment and sort of spun what would be, you know, a negative into a positive.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have the phone caller waiting to get with us. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, fellas. This is a great program. Listen, you just mentioned Howard Dean. I wanted to talk for a second about his candidacy. While he's really painted as somebody who's so far off the left spectrum that it's kind of not even worth debate, I just wanted to know, Mr. Schechter, what's your impression that this guy really is a threat to the Republicans, and do they feel that he's a threat? And maybe that's why he's always painted as such a kind of lunatic, even though his positions are...
Well, I think the administration initially, you know, wanted Dean, you know, liked the idea that Dean was being the front runner because they felt that at the end of the day, he would be an easy target because of lack of experience, because he had waffled on a lot of issues, because, you know, he's trying to be, you know, anti-war, but yet he's also trying to be centrist and all these things. I don't know if you saw this week with George Stephanopoulos, you know, traveling with him, harassing him, and Dean is challenging him back and all the rest of this. So I think, you know, on the one hand, you know, Dean is a comer, and everybody is noting he's getting big crowds and raising big money. They tend to be sort of what you would call yuppies, as far as I can see from the crowd mix that I've seen. He's like the Gene McCarthy of this generation. He's igniting a lot of enthusiasm and support. And he's sort of come out of nowhere to do that, which is very interesting when the you know, bigger names like John Kerry or Dick Gephardt and all the rest of them are you know, not exactly catching fire, you know, in the heartland of America. So, I think he is becoming more and more of a serious candidate. And what makes you a serious candidate, i.e. you can raise money, that makes you a serious candidate in the eyes of the media. And B, because you're in the media, therefore you're a serious candidate. Dennis Kucinich, for example, who may be a lot more progressive in his outlook, is not in the media as much as Dean, so people don't know what he stands for and ditto for other candidates.
Right, yeah, and actually I was going to make that point that nobody even paid attention to him until he was newsworthy enough because he had raised money. Then all of a sudden, not his ideas, not his, you know, background or his base or anything, it's his money that really sort of made him a candidate.
Yeah, but, I mean, I saw him speak at, you know, C-SPAN carried a rally he did here in New York.
You're talking about,
you know,
Dean
half of what he talked about was the money he's raised.
Dean, you're talking about Danny?
Dean.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for your time.
But again, I'm not open because I don't really know that much about him. I'm still sort of learning about him. It's interesting that he's a doctor. It's interesting. It's also apparently interesting that he's also very well. I mean, the New York Times pointed out that he also went to top private schools and is as much of a patrician in a way as George Bush.
Yeah, we're talking to Danny Schachter today in Media Matters. We still have another 10 or so minutes if folks would like to call in at 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Danny, tell us a little bit about MediaChannel.org, which you've been the executive editor of for several years now.
Well, you know, I got into media basically to try to spotlight problems of the world. And in the course of working in radio and in television at CNN, at ABC News, and, you know, in Global Vision, our independent television company, you know, I came to see that one of the problems of the world is the media itself, but it's often not acknowledged as such. It's often not focused on as such. Even when people trying to change America talk about the problems of America, media tends to be last on their list, even though, as we've just seen with the congressional response to the FCC issue, it's actually an issue that has galvanized Americans across the spectrum in ways that we haven't seen before. So it's actually a very central issue, but it's been sort of treated as something that's the side issue when I tend to think of it as the central issue, the central contradiction, and the power of the media corporations and the like. So, we got involved in this, and we had a lot of experiences trying to get programming on human rights and other issues on the air and running into a buzzsaw of opposition. You know, this is not corporate friendly in one instance, you know, not for us, and NFU from other programmers, we don't do programming about the world, et cetera, and so forth. And so we began to see that media was not only a problem for us as journalists and producers, but a problem for people all over the world, and we decided to try to do something about it. So I wrote in this book, The More You Watch, The Less You Know, I suggest that a media channel is a way to watch the other channels, thinking maybe we could do it on TV. Of course, that was not possible, but we did do it on the internet. We've created MediaChannel.org. In 1990, we had 20 organizations that agreed to be part of it at the time. We now have 1,058 organizations that are on board, with 200 more wanting to be part of it, which we're just, you know, processing their applications right now. And the site is about trying to both monitor media, advocate on media issues, educate on media issues. We have researchers, we have publications, we have independent journalists, we have people who relate to media. And we're also trying to build some sort of a bridge between the independent media world and the mainstream media world. Like, for example, the American Society of Newspaper Editors agreed to join, and even the Conservative News Service agreed to join. So we're trying to create a space in the internet space where people can actually talk about, we have a Citizens Media Watch, can actually talk about these issues. And every day I write a weblog, which started on September 11th, and I've just obsessively continued it, you know, mm-hmm. which sometimes is 3,000 or more words a day, just focusing on looking at the news through the prism of media and media issues. And we've now done three books. One was about the Florida election and about, called Mediocracy, about what happened, Hail to the Thief, about the election of 2000. We did another one called Media Wars, News at a Time of Terror, about how news changed since 9/11, and now Embedded Weapons of Mass Deception. So we're trying to get information out. We're trying to participate in the media and democracy movement. We've been handicapped a little bit by funding problems, which we hope to be turning around and trying to revitalize a media channel. We have a new executive director, Timothy Carr, has joined us. And I think Media Channel is doing well because it responds to a need. And we get tremendous amount of mail and participation from people all over the world who are interested in finding out more about the media, from media students and the like.
All right.
So that's what we do.
Yeah, sounds great. Danny Schachter, our guest today in Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Champagne, you're on the air with Danny Schachter.
Hello. I'm calling because I have adopted the thesis that one of the major failings of our Republican form of government today is the lack of a major independent news media. And so I'm calling to want to ask whether or what are, in your estimation, major media, newspapers, television networks, radio networks that are genuinely, quote, independent and not simply propaganda tools of the existing government.
I mean, all of them would claim to be independent, but...
Yeah, I know they claim, but when you look at the coverage...
Yeah, I think
there's
a distinction...
There's a disparity there between claim and actual practice, in my estimation.
Okay, well, let me just... You asked the question, I'd like to try to answer it. You know, we have a corporate form of organization and commercial organization in most of our media, and even our public broadcasting system tends to be tepid and not very feisty in its coverage, independent in its spirit, in terms of how it covers things, even though there are some good programs on, you know, from time to time, and people like Bill Moyers and others who are doing very good work. Most of the what we've seen is not only a merger of more and more media properties and companies, but a merger of newsbiz and showbiz, so that showbiz values tend to infiltrate most news coverage. What that means is we have more and more celebrity coverage, more and more storytelling, but less and less information, investigative journalism, and the like. Also, because of this consolidation, most of American cities are now one newspaper towns. And if the media companies get their way, you know, major newspapers will be able to own, you know, television stations in their own markets and the like. And so what this is doing is shrinking diversity of expression. And when you have a war going on, and at the same time the media companies are lobbying the FCC for regulatory relief and changes, you know, while they're demanding that the FCC waive the regulations, the media starts waving the flag and supporting policy and not, you know, abdicating its job. And that's what we've seen in the past year in dramatic form, actually going back to 9/11 when, you know, anchors started wearing American flags in their lapels. So all of this is, in a way, the American media is totally out of step with the media in the rest of the world. All you have to do is watch Canadian broadcasting if you can, or check out internet sites, and you'll see a different type of coverage. Some of it's better, not all of it. I don't think everything is wrong about that. I think there's some good people working in the media, and there's important information, but I think we can do a much, much better job. And in fact, rather than enhancing democracy, in many cases, the media is retarding democracy.
Yeah, Danny, if I can I interject and follow up on the caller's question? Let's say he wants to find, you know, he wants to just consume some media in the United States. What would you recommend? I mean, if he can't go to the BBC website or Canadian.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, I think there's several categories of information that you could find certainly on the internet. One is independent and, you know, critical publications. Magazines like The Progressive, In These Times, Mother Jones, our outlets, newspapers, even like the Christian Science Monitor, that cover the world somewhat differently than the mainframe press. On the media front, there are kind of indie media sites, indiemedia.org, freespeech.org, WorldLink Television is doing a good job, of offering other perspectives on stories.
What about NPR and PBS? I mean, you worked with PBS. They put your show on periodically for years, and we're on an NPR affiliate right now. Where do they fit into the mix? What's your take on that?
Again, it's an uneven situation. I think that there are, particularly at the local level, CBS and NPR stations that are doing a terrific job. I think once you get national, once you base your operation in Washington, beltway mentality tends to take over, and you know it tends to get more moderate, more conservative, less open to diverse points of view. Although NPR, I think, is still better in that respect than PBS, from what I've been able to see and hear.
Danny, we've got a caller I want to get to because we've only got a couple minutes left. Let's go back to the phone lines. Dixon, Illinois, you're on the air with Danny Schechter.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
Quick comment. Seems to me that about four-fifths of the media spend its time either repeating or commenting about the one-fifth that's actually doing something. Any comments?
Very acute observation. You know, there is a tremendous amount. If you just sat on your television set with a pencil just made a mark every time you've heard the same stories repeated over and over and over again. And then you began to look at what are the sources of these stories. Are there just one source? Are there multiple sources? Is there diverse viewpoints? In other words, you can become a media monitor yourself. And I think when you do that, it's very revealing. You begin to find out more. The key here is we have to take responsibility for our own media choices also. We have to try to not just blame them. We have to take charge and try to find other sources, mediareform.net, mediachannel.org, many other places where you will find information and news that you do not find in the mainstream media spectrum. And blaming somebody else, I think we should be critical. I think we should fight the power, so to speak. But I think at the same time, we have the responsibility to educate ourselves.
Danny Schechter, what are your next projects going to be moving on to the coming months and years?
Well, very frankly, it's a very tough fight to try to survive as an independent producer. Right now, it's an open question about whether we'll be able to. Media Channel, I feel, is really important. I'm continuing to work with it. We're trying to strengthen it. WMD, my film about media coverage of the war, I've done a 20-minute promo tape. I'm looking for people who might be interested in supporting it and might be interested in helping us get the film made. Barbara Koppel, the great filmmaker, has agreed to join us as an executive producer, so maybe that will help. I'm also working on a project on 9/11, the unanswered questions of 9/11, to see if we can get that out. I have a book.
Yeah, let's talk about it. We've only got a minute or so left, but I've read a recent column you wrote about that. The 9/11 terrorist attack, what are the unanswered questions? What are the things that would be very important for us to know that we don't know yet?
Well, of course, when you raise any questions at all, you're denounced as a conspiracy theorist. But actually, it's Bush that has the conspiracy theory. Al-Qaeda did it. They're the bad guys, the evildoers, et cetera, and so forth. What people are raising questions about is why the Air Force didn't scramble to try to stop these attacks when they had, ample warning, and it was against their protocols not to do so. There's information about why the government didn't act when they had direct warnings from foreign governments and from their own intelligence services about the threat that existed, why no efforts were made to tighten airline security before September 11th, the first attacks on the World Trade Center, something wasn't done to try to get people to learn evacuation procedure. In other words, there are two theories here. One is sort of the accident. It was a screw-up set of questions. And then there's something that goes deeper than that. Some of it is kind of far-fetched. Missiles were used. The World Trade Center was blown up. There was no plane at the Pentagon. There's a lot of people with theories, some of which seem kind of fantasy-like.
But until you have a serious investigation, those sort of
theories
are going to...
And that's the thing. We have an investigation underway now because four women in New Jersey who lost their husbands basically pushed the government to do it, but it wasn't funded at a proper level. It's halfway done. It hasn't reported on what it's doing.
Danny Schechter, unfortunately, I'm going to have to pull the plug now. We've only got a few seconds left. I want to thank Danny Schechter for being our guest.
You media manipulators. Okay.
All right, and I want to thank Victor Picard, the producer. And we'll see you later. Thank you very much. See you next week, folks.